Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're talking about the future of space with Inspiration4 Commander, Jared Rook Isaacman. We'll be discussing lessons learned from the mission, the space industry, and how this mission will affect the overall space enterprise writ large. For those that are unaware, just 2 months ago, Rook and his team completed their training and became the first all-civilian crew to orbit the planet. They set their goals very high, literally, orbiting well above the International Space Station. For 3 days, they soared 575 miles above Earth, conducting experiments that will feed the requirements to get humans to Mars in the next few years. Now, this was really a historic flight for many reasons. Haley Arsenault is the youngest American to go to space and the first person to fly with a prosthesis. It was a result of her battle with childhood cancer. And Dr. Cyan Proctor is the first African-American female to serve as a spacecraft pilot. But more importantly, none of them were professional astronauts. And for me, that's where mission specialist Air Force veteran Chris Zembrowski represented all of us on this mission, the everyday person that dreams of going to space. So let's think about that for a second. Up until now, the vast majority of individuals that have flown in space were frankly the perfect human specimen, expertly groomed as they grew up in their particular ranks to be selected in an ultra-competitive environment to take on the responsibility of going to space for America. And given what was at stake during the initial space race, these pioneers were exactly what gave us the edge over our competitors and adversaries. All of these individuals paved the way for the progress of space exploration as we see it today. And now we're going next level with unprecedented access to space that will ultimately enable humans to be an interplanetary species. I mean, just saying that is incredible. And it's something that I didn't think would be in the realm of the possible, especially during my lifetime. So that said, the Inspiration4 mission also tremendously served humanity on Earth with the goal of raising and donating $200 million to the St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Thankfully, this mission was incredibly supported and the goal was surpassed, with donations now exceeding $250 million. For those that are unaware of the mission, there's a great Netflix documentary called Countdown that you'll want to watch to learn more about the mission specifics. Now, here's something for you, our listeners. We're kicking off our first giveaway for an Aerospace Advantage podcast flight suit patch. So check out the show notes and there'll be a link for a video that'll tell you more on how to get your hands on a patch. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce my friend and the commander of the Inspiration4 mission, Jared Rook Isaacman.
Hey, Slick.
Rook, I tell you, it's incredible to have watched the entire journey from an up close and personal perspective. And there's so much to talk about. And I really want to go back to square one and just get a little bit of, for our audience, a bit of your flying background and some of that history.
Yeah, sure. I started, first I've been an aviation enthusiast since, I was a kid, probably because I saw Top Gun, like everybody else. And, started right. Flying cool flight simulators, at least the best that a 486 computer could handle. And, I started my company when I was 16 and was actually burning myself out really early in life because I wasn't leaving the basement. And I started to fly. I kind of went back to that childhood passion. And just like, anybody else, you start in a single engine prop and you move to multi-engine. Just I wanted to fly jets. And I didn't really know at the time if in a civilian track you could fly, ex-military aircraft. And but I knew you had to start somewhere. So started flying a bunch of different jets, all sorts of Citation jets and, Beechcraft and, Gulfstream and, pretty quickly accumulated quite a bit of time. And then found my way into some of the warbird community, T-28, L-39, T-33. So I got to start flying those kind of ex-military aircraft in a civilian career, even started flying an A-4 Skyhawk in a Vietnam Heritage flight. And this actually brought me back to school. Because now I was exposed to things like the reserves and the guard, places where you could go and serve your country and fly amazing aircraft, while still keeping your day job. And, that took me actually to the New Jersey Air National Guard, flying the Mighty Viper and, kind of tried to progress on a decent path there. And, in the end, I really just kind of circle back to my day job is, you know, I got 1500 employees working for me. It's a lot of responsibility. I don't want to get too far away from that, but there's probably a way I can continue to expand my flying career. And that led me to flying air shows, which became the Black Diamond Jet Team, which you're very familiar with, because that's how you and I met when you came right off your Thunderbird tour and then you joined the team.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rook, I got to tell you, you know, I think the first time we met was when I was doing the Atlantic City Air Show and met you briefly at the Air National Guard. And I mean, those guys were so fired up just based on your resume and flying ability. But, you know, you seeing the big picture is to not just be a lieutenant and get yelled at for a burnt coffee and having a big company run is obviously massively important. And so, you know, obviously Black Diamond Jet Team was a great segue for us to develop Draken International. And one of the things that we've talked about, and I wanted to get your experience in business where, yeah, there is this catch 22 where you can't bid for a contract because you don't have a clearance, but you can't get a security clearance because you're not on contract. So can you talk to that a little bit from your vantage point?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, obviously it's like you know it better than anyone. You know, you were in charge of security for us at Draken, and you know how many years it took to kind of break down that door. And I think the answer is, right, it's not impossible, but it's not easy either. And that's a problem because it means, you know, the government just chooses the easy button all the time. Let's just go back to the big primes if we have a problem to solve. And the big primes they're not fast, they're not agile. And in fact, a lot of the way their contracts are structured is better to take more time and have more people involved in it. Because if you inflate the cost portion of it, then the plus side becomes that much sweeter. And that's not how you move fast. That's not how you change the paradigm or really innovate. It was a lot of work for us, as you know, at Draken to get that momentum and traction. Geez, from the time we founded the company until we had our first like meaningful contract, it was 4 or 5 years. And as you know, I'm pretty close to another organization now that's really changed the game on a far grander scale than we could have at Draken, which is called SpaceX. Man, they had to sue to get a chance. And now they're probably the most cutting edge organization out there in aerospace. And who knows how long it took them to get their clearances, how long it took them to start supporting government payloads. And where did that cost us? Well, it cost us in national defense for sure. It cost us as taxpayers because it means we were doing things the old way, the more costly way.
Sure. And talking specifically about SpaceX, you know, for me, I was just blown away. I mean, I knew what SpaceX was doing. And of course, when you see a reusable rocket, you know, the Falcon 9 come, you know, land on a drone in the middle of the ocean, I mean, unbelievable technology. But, you know, the other part is the people side of it and the opportunity to tour Kennedy Space Center with you before, you know, at the crew announcement and meet the folks that are making it happen, you know, going out to the launch pad. And I have to say, you know, the young person running it, you know, it was like a 29-year-old lady who is 8 months pregnant running up and down the steps of a 265-foot launch pad. So can you talk to some of, you know, your experience with government and compare that with what you're seeing in private industry?
Yeah, I mean, first, I've never seen, you know, a better run, more innovative organization than SpaceX. And I think that's pretty apparent to all of us, right? I mean, you watch those simo landing of the two first stage boosters, you know, back at the KSC landing zones or the fact that they've caught nearly, you know, 90 some odd boosters now on drone ships in the water. I mean, this is all the science fiction becoming reality and it's pretty incredible. But, you know, there's a lot of pieces to making that happen. To your point, so like they're all like the average age of the 10,000 SpaceX employees is about 28. They're specifically trying to hire very talented, motivated people who believe in their vision and mission, you know, right out of school and showing them the SpaceX way. They really don't want people that have been at the big primes that may have already learned things a way that, that they just do things differently. And it's impressive. It's impressive to see young people with so much responsibility. But just to point out, this isn't new for our country, by the way. It might be new recently. This might be, you know, a 30 or 40 year development. But if you look at the early days of the space program, the engineers that built, you know, Mercury and Gemini and Apollo, those working in mission controls, they look just like, you know, maybe their ties were a little thinner and they were smoking a lot, but they look just like the SpaceX employees of today. So you know, I actually think that, you know, Elon and his team looked back on maybe the days that we worked the fastest, when we worked at our best, when we achieved the most, and said, how do you bring that to modern times? And that lives at SpaceX. But it also means that the industries that supported the early days of the space program have come so far and probably in the wrong direction from those glory days.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I think we even talked about that on the podcast with the lightweight fighter competition. I think there were like 17 or 18 companies that were trying to develop. We now know as the, you know, won the F-16 from General Dynamics. But yeah, you're right. I mean, maybe we in our generation haven't seen this level of innovation or competition, but surely is coming back, and it needs to, because we've slighted our taxpayers and the innovation in space in general. I mean, we just seem to have ignored space for a while. And so I want to continue talking about the space piece quickly. You know, obviously you were the mission commander for the Inspiration 4 mission. And for those that haven't seen the documentary on Netflix, absolutely need to check it out. I'll give you all the background you'd get to need. But specifically, I want to talk about actually the human to machine interface that you had as the commander and the person flying the Dragon capsule. So can you talk to some of that for us?
Yeah, sure. You know, it is a very intelligent vehicle. And, you know, I give a lot of credit all the time, of course, to SpaceX, because they are amazing. And well, they put me into space and brought me home safely, so they deserve some credit. But they didn't do it alone. I mean, that was a partnership with NASA. NASA helped contribute to the funding, the design, the safety system. So you got a lot of NASA influence in it too. Which means that for as much automation and amazing technology exists, there's backup systems, because, you know, people sometimes incorrectly cite that just because a cargo dragon can go to the space station and come home without a human being in it, that therefore the crew dragon must be the same. Well, the difference is there's a human being in a crew dragon. And we're going to want to make sure that if there's even, you know, a Hail Mary effort to bring people home, when a human being's on board a spacecraft, we're going to enable that. And that comes with, you know, a lot of redundancy and a lot of manual capabilities. You know, the obvious things as a pilot is, well, there's no stick and there's no throttle. That doesn't mean those capabilities don't exist. They're just embedded in a touchscreen. And that really shouldn't surprise us, right? I mean, we're all pretty good on our iPhones and our iPads. I mean, you know, it felt like every version, at least in the early days not the early days, but in the last 20 years of Apple, was like, well, is there a button here we can remove? Then let's do it. But that didn't mean we lost functionality. We gained it. We just gained it through a different interface. And that's pretty much the story of Dragon. Dragon, it has all of the type of controls and inputs you would need to manually control attitude, to manually control propulsion. You can dock on the space station in a manual mode if needed. There are reasons to manually change attitude based on pointing your antennas towards the geo belt for greater communication, pointing your solar panels towards the sun to charge your batteries. So a lot of capabilities in it. If something goes wrong, you have to be able to come home on your own in a worst case scenario. I think we were pretty fortunate in our mission that there weren't a lot of things that went wrong, but it was still great to have that training and exposure to the capabilities of the vehicle.
Well, Rook, you know, it was just an absolutely incredibly inspirational mission by design. And again, congratulations on exceeding your goal of $200 million for St. Jude's. But I'm sure you have a lot of lessons learned. And the reality was, you know, the cool thing was everybody was not a professional astronaut. I mean, obviously yourself being a pilot and Dr. Proctor being a private pilot, but can you talk about some of the lessons learned that you've had on, you know, how fighter jet training was important for the crew, or other things that you did to bring everybody up to speed to make sure that they were successful on this mission? And, you know, what recommendations you may have for future mission training, whether it be at SpaceX or any other company?
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack there. First, I thought our training was exceptional, and, you know, really, honestly, the minimum you can probably get away with for that vehicle, which is Dragon, because it is built where there are four crew members and four crew members have responsibilities. And you need to be comfortable in them, because, you know, we had come out 15% of our mission duration. And why? Because it was the first private mission, which means you didn't get a priority on government assets, whether it's satellite based or ground stations, you know, things that could be deconflicted for a government mission because it is a national priority weren't available to us. So you have to be comfortable working, on your own in the spacecraft for some period of time. There were alarms, some things didn't work entirely as planned, and that creates, that can create stress if you don't feel like you're adequately trained to handle it. You know, we heard alarms go off 1,000 times in the simulator before we ever heard it happen, up in space. So, I would say that, even we benefited in some ways. We had 2 days of space medicine and flight physiology training. I think you only got away with 2 days of it because you had a physician assistant, as our medical officer. We gave shots up on orbit. Drawing medicine in microgravity is not the same as drawing meds here on Earth. And, if we didn't have Haley, I think you need more training. When I sat in front of the displays for the first time, and even Dr. Proctor is a private pilot, you didn't have to kind of talk us through the basics of navigating across screens. We just had to go in and learn what was different for the spacecraft. I think if you had four people who had no aviation background whatsoever, you need even more time. So that was just kind of general duration. If you design a vehicle like Starship, with 100 people on it, and you have, 4 or 5 designated crew members, and then the rest just need to focus on what they need to do to be productive and comfortable and happy in space, you can cut that down a lot. Now, in terms of we had, 4 crew members that never knew each other before, right? Like we didn't go to school together. We didn't work together. There was a whole degree of randomness in terms of how they were selected. The stars aligned because they're all awesome and they all did great. But it did take a lot of work outside of just SpaceX training to get us to that point. So, and honestly, I drew a lot from my experiences flying air shows together. I drew a lot from Draken that you do need structure. There does need to be discipline around it. So we introduced, everyday briefs, debriefs, things that weren't part of their way of life before. What are we trying to learn today? How did it work out at the end? And how can we do it better for tomorrow? That became our routine for 6 months. We studied together. If you're late for the push time at the hotel in the morning, you're going to get ridiculed. And I'll tell you, over 6 months, it changed people. It shaped them. Going up on Mount Rainier, taught people where they're, where those limits were, and they're a lot farther away than they might think they are. Getting comfortable being uncomfortable, developing mental toughness. The fighter jet weekend thing was absolutely the same thing. It was late in training, so it's not a disqualification, but it is an opportunity to show that, hey, you can still function. You can be a contributor when you're undergoing a lot of stress, because you don't get the opportunity to just hit the pause button when you're going uphill or downhill in a Dragon. So I think all these things came together to make us a really, cohesive team, and a crew that could perform well in space.
Rook, yeah, and I really appreciate that. And you mentioned something that I want to really jump into with you, and that was one word, Mars. Again, having the opportunity to travel with you to Starbase, and I think rolling up to the gates, you basically were like, all right, dude, this is going to be a religious experience. And, of course, when you say something like that, I know it's going to hit home. But even beyond, your words, experiencing what the people have built in the middle or, the bottom of the state down there in Texas and the goals that they have set. And of course, like we already talked about, the youth and the energy that's down there. But this goes beyond the idea that, oh, maybe one day humans may go to Mars. You have to bring us up to speed. This is like a reality. Like this is happening within a couple of years at the most, right?
Yeah. And man, I hope you don't mind me just, kind of expanding on this question a little bit because it's one I'm really passionate about. So SpaceX is building, as you're referring to, Starbase in Boca Chica, Texas, middle of nowhere. They're building this city, and the city is going to be our gateway to the moon again, to Mars, and beyond. And I have to imagine it has some of that Manhattan Project, Los Alamos feel to it, of creating something out of really nothing and it having such worldly implications as Starbase and Starship does. But I want to point out how different all of this is relative to how the big defense and aerospace industry operates today. If there is a competition for a new tanker or something, the one or two companies that are thinking about bidding on it, go to a bunch of different cities and try and lobby for a bunch of funding and grants to build out their infrastructure there. And they don't do any of it unless they win a contract. They don't embark on building production facilities for spaceships, designing spaceships, testing spaceships, building engines, unless somebody gives them a contract to do it. I mean, we would joke at Draken, like, you're not going to get a big defense company to even touch a keyboard without an R&D contract to support it or something like that. Now, what does SpaceX do? They say, you know, the world is going to be a more interesting place if people can journey among the stars. We are going to learn so much more that we can't even possibly comprehend now that'll make, you know, our life as human beings on Earth better and more fulfilling if we just get out there. So what is the most logical place we should mass produce these spaceships that have their own on-base propellant? So they built it on top of a giant methane reserve that has access, to launch without overflying parts of the United States on a prograde orbit, that has talent that's going to be affordable, that can also be done in a way that's on a non-interference to, you know, other big urban or areas. Let's just go build infrastructure now, and we'll assume that there's going to be demand for what we're trying to accomplish later. I thought it was funny when the government, who's awarding a lunar lander contract right now for us to get back to the moon, and they awarded to SpaceX because they already had Starship so far along, and it's designed to land here on Earth, it's designed to land on the moon, it's designed to land on Mars, and they've been testing it because we've been seeing the results of the test for now well over a year. They gave it to the lowest cost and best provider, and that was SpaceX. And then there was a protest by the far more expensive solution that hasn't been tested, which is a conglomerate of multiple big defense primes, not unlike what we've seen with other very expensive programs out there. And then GAO issued a stop work order, which is very common with protests. And I found that so humorous because I was like, they started doing this without your money, and they're going to keep doing it without your money. And that is so unique in defense aerospace now. And if there is a day for, even put Mars on hold for a second, where this country feels the urgency to get back to the moon, maybe before another superpower like China gets there, which I'm really afraid could actually happen, that they went from, a far less mature state of a space program compared to us who landed on the moon in 1969. I think they could get there faster than us if we don't get in gear, and we'll thankfully have a program like SpaceX that could actually do it if really called upon, and not be caught up in endless protests because they're dependent on the next dollar to come back from the government. They're just funding it themselves. That's what Starbase represents to us. That is a city out of nowhere that is going to be self-sustaining with a great workforce and an optimal location to build a lot of vehicles, not one or 10, but hundreds, that will take America to the moon, and it will take the world to Mars and beyond. And this isn't a 50-year PowerPoint dream. This is happening every single day. And you saw it with your own eyes.
Yeah. And, I don't think people understand the magnitude, and I certainly didn't, but until I physically stood underneath and looked up into the nose cone of a Starship, and, you looked over at me and you're like, this thing has more volume in it in one rocket than the entire International Space Station. And from what I understand, the plan is not to do the typical government NASA, whatever thing, to send a couple people out, pick up some rocks and come back. They're going to send an armada of multiple starships with, 100 people per on the manned rockets. And then, of course, all the equipment and sustainability for them to start building when they hit the ground. It's like a mission. You get there and then they start building, which, I think about what you did with Inspiration 4 and taking 4 non-professional astronauts to space. Like, this is how we're going to get really talented welders and other folks to get out to another planet to start building. And that's how we're going to do it. I did want to ask you quickly about how you see the government, though, working with, since you have so much experience in the private sector, and kind of merging these two things. And it's not, you know, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, there are places like the Air Force Research Lab or AFRL, where they've worked with SpaceX in the past to help develop. So how do you see the future of the U.S. government? And I know that you're a patriot and you've talked a lot about that, but really merging this new technology with a government system to make sure that we're doing this right by the taxpayer.
Yeah. Well, the good news is we're at least making progress. It's not, I think, as horrendous as it was a few years ago. But we need a lot more of it. You know, I sometimes come across as like a SpaceX fanboy, where it's SpaceX will solve all our world's problems, just give them the money. That's actually not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying the country just needs a lot more SpaceXs. You know, if we take a look at aerospace specifically, you've got SpaceX for sure, but you have Rocket Lab. It's a New Zealand-based company that now has gone public in the United States. They have facilities here in the U.S. They've incorporated in the U.S. It's going to be a low-cost means to put payload into space. In fact, they are working under an AFRL contract and NASA contracts now. It's not just them anymore. You got Astra. They're launching out of Alaska right now. You've got Firefly Aerospace. What are we hearing right now? We're hearing about competition. Competition fuels innovation and delivers results at a lower cost. You know, you rewind the clock 15 years ago, and you had the big defense primes who created a merger of ULA, which had no incentive to really innovate or drive down costs. It actually was a result of SpaceX that drove down their costs considerably. Well, good. Now let's have more. Let's have Firefly and Astra and Rocket Labs. We need that everywhere else. We've literally watched the defense industry consolidate to the point where if America needs a new bomber or a new fighter, you're going to get two bids, maybe three, and they'll probably wind up working out some sort of a work share between each other. And then there's no incentive whatsoever to drive down costs or innovate, because you don't want to lose your portion of the work share. So its reality is we just need an awful lot more companies like SpaceX that are willing to go in and tackle these problems so that we can, you know, start to pick up the pace again and get a whole lot more for a lot less. Right now, I mean, I think if you take NASA's official position of what puts our moon landing at jeopardy, it's the spacesuit. They're like $1.5 billion over budget on the spacesuit. You can't tell me with all of the talent that we have in Silicon Valley and other, you know, tech heavy hubs in this country, we can't figure out how to make a spacesuit for less than $1.5 billion. That's just what they're over budget for, by the way, in order to make sure we can get America back to the moon and be the leaders in space. There's a lot of examples like that. And I think part of it is just this fear that exists now throughout, our political leadership, that, you know, if you don't keep feeding the base, that it'll fall apart. The jobs will just disappear. And we know that's not the case. They change polo shirts. If one company figures out how to do something better than the other one, puts them out of business and advances national interests at a lower cost, first of all, that's very American. Second, they're not out of work for life. They're just going to get hired at that other company, and they're going to make an awful lot more of what we need for the same price that we would have gotten a lot less for had we done it the old way. But we haven't learned these lessons yet, because you still have a rocket that we are counting on to go back to the moon that's going to cost about $1.5 billion a launch, which is 10x or so the published price of a Falcon Heavy, which the government just moved a satellite payload that would have launched at $1.5 billion over to a Falcon Heavy, which in my mind certainly validates that that you can do more with an awful lot less. So we're still kind of stuck in that we need to create jobs programs, which we need to, you know, endorse consolidation when we should be doing the exact opposite.
Well, Rook, I couldn't agree more. And this is how we're going to accelerate the change that's needed. And I'm going to say something that's not going to be super popular with my fighter pilot friends, but I have to go back to a statement that Elon made when visiting AFA a couple years ago, basically saying that, as we know it, the fighter pilot era is dead. And I have to say that I do agree with that, in the sense that as we grow into our future, things need to evolve. And, you know, looking back at history, knights were cool with shiny armor and broadswords riding on horseback, but obviously they went to the way of the dodo bird, I guess. So maybe the way that we know fighter pilots and the way that things are going to progress with technology through aircraft and unmanned vehicles and man-to-man teaming or manned-unmanned teaming, that fighter pilots are going to morph into something different than we know exactly today. So what do you see as a future of air and space power?
You know, Elon has these philosophies that he's ingrained within all of his people on how you get things done fast that are real difference making and high quality. And one component of that philosophy, which I have embraced wholeheartedly and I am doing everything I can to imprint it on my day job here at Shift4, is to take out parts. The best part is no part. And, you know, at first glance, you might almost take it too literally, that a part must be like a component of a broader machine that will eventually fail. But reality is, like, there are parts everywhere. Steps in a checklist are parts. People are parts. And if you think about a fighter jet, for example, and say, well, if the person, which is a part, needs to be in there, then what other parts do I need in order to support that person? There's life support, ejection seats, there's controls. These things add weight and they come at a penalty of some other degree of performance. So in that spirit of we should have been able to advance our automation, our capabilities to such an extent that in some circumstances, the actual physical, you know, fighter pilot in a fighter jet might be an unnecessary part at some extent. And we got to be bold enough to, you know, step forward and embrace some of these things, lean forward so that we aren't the ones that are heavily invested in battleships, when the aircraft start flying overhead, and that we don't learn lessons, from the past again at great consequence. So, yeah, I mean, I just like you, I love strapping in and pulling G's too. And I think the thought process and the attitude that goes into making a fighter pilot will certainly remain. It just might be, wielding a different type of technology in order to achieve the same results.
So, Rook, we talked a lot about your experience in going to space and what companies are doing to make the dream of space travel a reality in the near future. But what about our adversaries like China? How do you see competition in space with China panning out?
You know, just recently China wrapped up, their big air and space, show, like their version of Farnborough, and obviously unveiled a lot of interesting technology. But one that I thought was pretty interesting was the Long March 9, and this being their platform to take human beings to the moon. And they said they're going to have people and infrastructure on the moon by 2030. You know, I was just thinking, it's great that, the world wants to go out and kind of discover and satisfy curiosity and just try and tap into all that the universe can potentially teach us. But I'd still like America to be the one that's out there doing it first and leading the charge. And I can't say for sure right now that, one, that 2030 in their eyes isn't actually 2025. I don't think they have any reason to give an aggressive number. I think they could be very conservative and surprise us. I think that would be a really... I think that'd be a big blow to the United States, right? China is on a path to becoming, to surpassing us as an economic power. I don't actually think there's anything we could do to even change that at this point. I think it's in the numbers, but, I think it'll be a big, big day if we're all watching, on our screens and see, the Chinese astronauts on the moon before us, before getting back. It's a huge statement because they didn't start from as strong of a technological position as we did, leading the space race back in the 60s and 70s, and to surpass us like that, I think would be, I think it'd be a really significant blow. So when I think about some of the issues that are in, facing, politics right now, do we need two lunar landers to be funded at the same time at the expense of making expedited progress on one? We didn't have two lunar landers, in the 60s. We picked a design, we backed them. It had some teething pains for sure, but it got us to the moon. Well, for 10 years, this country accepted sending American astronauts to space via Russia. United Launch Alliance's heavy lift platform that puts NRO and other DOD assets into space does it on a Russian engine. Okay, so for a very long time, we've accepted not even having one provider in the United States, let alone two. And now when I think it matters most for us to be prioritized getting back to the moon and beyond, we need two. And that too is going to cost us delays. And I think everybody, regardless of the political party, should think of the implications if they're the ones in office when the country loses the moon. And that's a real possibility. So I hope we can get back on track and start making progress at the pace I know firsthand from what I've seen we can work at.
Yeah, well, we are living the next great space race. So it's pretty incredible to be part of. Okay, Rook, I have one little bit of a silly request, but it's a flying story. So I know you and I have flown a ton together, but we have quite a number of stories. But I want to ask you, whether it's a fighter jet or something else, what was the most memorable experience you had in the cockpit?
Wow, most memorable experience in the cockpit. Ugh. You know, it's like I don't know if I can just pick one. You know, I got to fly the first L-159 in the country, which became the workhorse of Draken. Got to land the first one at Nellis, which was super cool. You know, in my early days, long before Draken, I got to fly an A-4 in a Vietnam Heritage flight at Oshkosh, which was pretty incredible. You know, I feel like every time we came down from an air show and you know, could all shake hands that and kind of share in the satisfaction of it was pretty damn cool. Yeah, I mean, obviously we all had a lot of good memories flying with Snort, who's somebody we're pretty close to and we lost, unfortunately, a few months ago. So yeah, I don't think I can hone in on one. What about you?
Oh, you know, I tell you, I'm in the same boat. I mean, yeah, I just remember the big high five and bro hug at the end, you know, going down the line. You can't, if you could bottle that energy and that feeling, of course, supporting folks on the ground in my combat experience was pretty tremendous. But then it was also flying in a business jet with you and some crazy winds in Europe and stuff like that. So, I mean, I think, you know, I'm with you. It's all over the map, but I think at the end of the day, it's the experiences that aviation brings to us, whether it be fighter jets or, you know, even in like my old Stearman, I have a ball flying that airplane too. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's pretty tough to think about your best time in an airplane.
Yeah, for sure, man. Cool. People is a big part of it too. We got a good community. So.
Absolutely. Again, Rook, I can't say thanks enough for you taking time out of your tremendously busy schedule to chat with us.
Well, thanks, Slick. Appreciate it, man.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.